Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, the news, remote learning. Are you feeling like you and your kids have turned into tech zombies? I'm Monalee, former radio personality, elementary school librarian, and current mom of two, who is the host of Cherishing Childhood, the low-tech parenting podcast where research meets real life. Every Wednesday, I bring you research-based information as well as activities, tips, and tricks to help you raise smart, happy, healthy kids with limited technology. Find Cherishing Childhood, the low-tech parenting podcast on Apple Podcasts or any of your favorite podcasting platforms.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode is brought to you by the Slash and Cast Podcast Network. Learn more at slashandcast.net.
Hey everyone, today I have a co-host, and he is not only a great friend, but he is talented, has many podcasts, and co-hosts many podcasts. He's a hard worker and a really great human. I love him to death. This is Caleb from Horror Soup, and tell him about all your other podcasts. You have like 20.
Oh, this seems absurd. So I guess I started podcasting a couple years back. I started doing a show called Horror Soup, where I covered horror movies and true crime. Don't really do that anymore, and that's why Paige here was nice enough to let me come and steal her show for a little bit, and then talk about things she probably doesn't want me to talk about on her show. And then I do another horror movie show called Scream with Ash and Elena, and then do something called Donkey Fellatio, which I'll just leave that there.
Oh my gosh. Okay, well, are you ready to dive into this case about Michael Alec and the murder of Angel Melendez?
Yeah, so you said we're kind of going to just start at like the very beginning with Alec himself, right?
Yeah. He was born on April 29th in 1966 in South Bend, Indiana. He grew up in a small town and he was in the closet. And this is like a lot of stories that you hear about in small towns about people who are in the LGBTQ plus community and they feel like they can't come out because small towns are just sometimes not as accepting of that. Other lifestyles, other people's beliefs. So that was really hard on him.
Yeah, man. Can you imagine growing up in Kentucky? It's fucking terrible.
Yeah. And everywhere that is not east or west is Kentucky to Caleb, for those that may not know.
No. Anything that isn't like California or New York or like Massachusetts can pass to is fucking Kentucky. It's all a bunch of bullshit. Don't try to tell me you're not Kentucky when you're grade A Kentucky.
I can't stand you. Oh, my
Most
God.
Can't. Thank you.
No, but okay, so in the 70s and 80s, he was in this little town. He was into so many things that your normal or typical, stereotypical straight boys were not into. And he was bullied not only by guys, but by girls too. And he was into fashion. he was just so not happy where he was, and he wanted to go somewhere that he felt would be more accepting of him. So after he graduated Penn High School, he got the hell out of Indiana, aka Kentucky.
Shout out to James.
And he moved to New York in the fall. He wanted to find like-minded people and kind of build like his own community of people that he could relate to and identify with. His parents got a divorce, and his father was not at all accepting of him, and they never really communicated. So he was dealing with a lot, and he just wanted to get the hell out of there. So he thought New York would be the place where he would find happiness and friends.
And you know, he's probably right, because you kind of do need to just get the hell out of those situations. His story kind of really reminds me of my story, like kind of growing up and figuring everything out and whatnot. And even the family situation, I kind of wish I had the opportunity to leave and go to New York at one time too, and I didn't. And what? I don't know. I think it might have been a good idea, but at the same time, after this story, who knows? Maybe not.
Yeah, maybe it was just best not to.
You never know, bud.
Yeah, you never know. Well, he's really made a name for himself, and he would throw these parties called Disco 2000. And he connected with everyone who he felt this kinship with. And like you said, you know, I think we all in some way want that too. We want to just make connections with people, and we want to be around people that we feel like understands us. And I think he really wanted to bring together that group of outcasts that were just really like him and he could relate to. So-called misfits and outsiders. And I think we can all relate to that on some level.
I think for sure. Didn't his parties kind of suck in the beginning?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they really did. He didn't really get a great start in New York.
Well, I mean, can you imagine being like, because how old was he exactly when he went to New York again? He was around...
Well, see, I couldn't quite find out his exact age, but it was right after he graduated high school. So I figured like 18 or 19.
Yeah, probably something like that. I actually feel like he could have even been younger. But I don't know. I feel like everything I found, it seemed like he was, between like 17 and 19 or something like that.
Yeah, and that's really young, trying to go somewhere and make a name for yourself, like right off the bat. So he was hustling pretty hard.
I mean, it's kind of impressive. I would not have known what to do. Like, I always respect when people are just like, oh, yeah, I'm just going to go like across the country, no money, no this or that and anything. Yeah. I'm like, the fuck are you going to do, dude?
Exactly. Oh my God, yeah. It's funny though when people have those stories. They're like, yeah, I went to LA with nothing but like a couple of bucks and just, you know, started my acting career. It's like, how does that even happen?
Yeah, I'm like, where did you sleep? Did you have possessions? Did you?
Yeah, really.
How did you not get robbed? I don't get it. Like, I live by LA, and if I just drove to LA for a night and didn't have somewhere to sleep, I'm pretty positive I would get like robbed at some point.
Hell yeah. It's really ballsy. You know, they were all about having this freedom to express their creativity. They would go out in their handmade outfits and wild makeup and party to the newest dance music and take drugs. And Nelson Sullivan was the one who, at the time, was like, everybody calls him like the first ever vlogger back in the 80s.
Because who the fuck was vlogging? And you go on YouTube and you look up these like Club Kid videos and shit, and they're just legit like full on vlogs of them like raiding McDonald's and like Burger King and just having giant parties.
It's so awesome. Because I just look at that and I'm like, damn, that looks like a good time. That just looks like somewhere I want to be. Those videos are awesome.
Well, those kind of remind me of like a bigger version of what I would do in high school, because we would have like the mall days and it would just be a bunch of kids like raiding the mall. We were like fucking probably anywhere from like 13 to 16 or something like that. And we would just raid the fucking, well, actually no, probably 13 to like fucking 23. Now I think about it, it was kind of a weird crowd too. And like, there was definitely some bad shit going on, but we would all just like do ecstasy and like fucking smoke weed and shit. And then we would go to like a Carl's Jr. around the corner, and it would be like 30 fucking scene kids just like packed in a fucking like,
yes, the
Carl's
scene
Jr.
kids. Yes.
I think it just goes in cycles.
I totally get that. Yeah, so everybody would basically call each other, and it would be like, okay, we're going to meet at this McDonald's at such and such time. Like, I don't know how they organized these parties really back then, because no cell phones, no anything like that. So you just had to pretty much, like, word of mouth book it to the McDonald's when everybody was just going to be there. That's crazy.
I think that works, though, because, like, even at the time, like, actually, this was back in, I said high school, but this was more like middle school when I was doing that stuff, because I was, like, 12 or 13, or, like, no, probably, like, 11 or 12 when I was doing that shit at the mall, because I did ecstasy at the mall when I was, like, 11 years old. But, like,
yeah.
At the time, like, I didn't always have a phone during those times, but I would always end up there with, like, a bunch of people. It was kind of just, like, people would be like, hey, we're going over here, we're meeting up, and I'd just fucking see one person, see another person, they're just like, yeah, we're going over there, and you'd fucking end up at this spot, and it was just, like, fucking 30, 40 kids doing drugs at Carl's Jr.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I can barely remember, like, what was going on before we had freaking cell phones and had to rely on a landline or a payphone to, like, figure out where everybody's at. It's insane.
It's insane because, like, back then, I didn't have a phone, and then I was like, oh, how do I contact these people? This is difficult, but get it done. And then now I have a phone and the means to, like, contact anyone at any given time, and I just don't answer now.
Me too. My social anxiety, I think, in the generation we grew up in, I think that's just how we are as people. We don't answer the phone. We rarely will check messages. Like, that's just who we are as people now.
Yeah, I mean, I look at, like, the time when I had a phone and I used to always have messages, and now I'm just like, or I would always have messages and I check them all, and now I'm just like fucking 50 unread messages. Yeah. I'm like, I'm never looking at that.
Yeah, I feel like I'm an 80-year-old, 90-year-old woman or something. It's just like, I'm letting the phone go, I'm not answering it, I'm just gonna lay here. Mm-hmm. But they would actually go in, and it wasn't like they would go into a McDonald's or a donut shop or whatever and not buy food. Like, they would order all this kind of food, but they would dance around and just party up. And, like, the Subway, they would go to the Subway, and just it would be hundreds of them just all up and down the Subway.
Well, can we start talking about the movie, like, kind of right now?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Because they kind of show that in the movie. It was, what, 2003 Party Monster?
Yes, I think it was 2003.
Yeah, so there is a movie recreation of this whole story, and obviously we haven't finished telling the story and whatnot, but even seems like this, that, like, show the, like, them raiding these fucking Carl's Juniors and shit, like, yeah. It would just be them pulling up all fancy as hell in their little outfits and, like, hey, let me get 300 cheeseburgers and just had them, like, a wad of cash or something. I'm like, yes. That's a whole fucking vibe.
Yeah, that really is. Oh my God, that would be so fun.
Sorry, I just have to mention, like, the fact that Macaulay Culkin and Seth Green are in this movie together is absurd. Like, I really like the movie. I think it was, like, really fun. And it wasn't even, like, it was a pretty good movie. And also, like, it was pretty over-exaggerated, which seemed to be the biggest complaints about it. But I feel like it kind of had to be to represent what it was discussing and what it was trying to recreate. Because they kind of were, like, extravagant and over-exaggerated, and, like, I feel like it kind of fit the movie, and, like, Seth Green was a very odd choice for James St. James. We obviously haven't even talked about him yet, but he's a very pivotal character in this whole story. But his character of James St. James, it's a fucking tongue twister, was really fucking funny, but also I just love Seth Green, so maybe I'm a little bit biased, but what is up with Macaulay Culkin? He plays the same character in every fucking role.
Yeah, that is true. But you know what? I had not seen the movie. I mean, I knew it had been out there. I did not know that it was actually based on a true story. But I was like, why have I never watched this movie before? And just like a month or so ago, I watched it and I was like, okay. And this was before Michael passed away. Spoiler alert, he did die on Christmas. Yeah,
he
and
just
died. It is kind of sad in a way, and I'll get into that later, but it's just, it gets complicated to me.
This story is so weird for me, because this is like the case that I really don't know how I feel about Michael. Like, obviously what we're going to get into is that Michael is the true crime aspect of this whole situation. The Club Kids in of themselves, they're not like, it's not like a cult. It's not, which when you first brought this to me, I assumed it was like some kind of like cult or something. And I was kind of confused researching it at first because I'm like, wait, what the fuck is going on? It just looks like this is a good swell
looks
time.
Like a good time.
And I'm
yeah.
like, yeah. And I was like, I can't find anything wrong with this. And then I get into Michael and I find out there's some other shit to it. But even his story in general, like with there's, this story's so weird because there's so many different accounts that go into it, so many different stories, so many different sides, that I don't know if I even hate Michael. Like, I don't think he's a great person, but I don't know if I'm, like, quick to be like, no, he is the worst person ever, like I am in other true crime cases, yeah. because it's just so fucking wacky, and I feel like this is one of those things that's just never gonna have a straightforward answer.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I just feel like I don't go, usually I'm like, oh my God, okay, so we hate this guy, we hate this guy. But in this one, it's, there's so much that you can relate to up to that point and even kind of afterwards that, and then you start feeling kind of bad, at least I do, because we'll see, you know, how this really affected his yeah. life and it's just really, okay, let me go on because you mentioned James St. James and he met him right around the time he got to New York in the late 1980s. But James and the others that were in the party scene back then, they really didn't want anything to do with Michael. So like you were saying, like it didn't come super easy for Michael when he got there. And he wasn't exactly welcomed with open arms. So Michael had to basically work for this respect and friendship. And that's when they started making that their own like Club Kid scene and promoting like crazy. James St. James was a celebutant at the time, and it's crazy because like I started off watching documentaries and you see who James St. James is today and he's kind of bigger. So when I watched the documentaries at first, I was like, God, that doesn't look anything like, where did they get Seth Green from? But then when I start watching, like, the old home videos, I kind of see with the red hair, like, he did used to have red hair, and just his slim face, he does kind of resemble Seth Green a tiny bit, I think.
Yeah, I think they look, like, fairly similar, but I don't know. It's just the Seth Green thing. Like, he's in so many things that I just see him, and I'm like, I can't see anything other than Seth Green. It's like, oh, there's Seth Green.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
He's such a odd character. And what it, the name celebutante, they said in a few documentaries what it was mixed with. Do you remember what that was?
I don't. And you know what? I was like, okay, I know kind of what a celebutante is, but, like, what exactly is it?
It's such a weird term, and I looked it up on, like, Urban Dictionary right now, and I'm just going to say that it really didn't help me that much. I mean, it says it's, like, it's a celebrity who's famous for nothing more than spending a successful parent's money, which they did kind of mention sometimes, but I remember in, like, one of the docs, they mentioned exactly what it was.
Yeah.
But
well,
I
guess
don't
you could
remember.
Say he might have spent, like, his parents' money to look really fabulous, and so he went out to all these parties and kind of got famous for being a party person, I guess, maybe.
I don't know. Every time I said it, I started thinking of this one John Travolta movie that was directed by Fred Durst. He played like a mentally challenged person in it, and it made like no money. But him and best friend called celebrities celebutards.
Oh, wow.
And I think it was kind of like still like the same basic thing a little bit, but
it was kind of just like ripping on like what a celebutant is, kind of like we're gonna make fun of it.
I don't know, that's what I want to assume, but I'm not entirely sure.
I don't know. Now James St. James, I would like to know kind of how he got so big, because for him it was like, okay, Michael's coming into our scene trying to make his own little community. And so I'm just like, I wonder what James's story is. So I'll have to look, like, and read more on that. But he did help Michael with the whole Disco 2000s party. He helped him with the idea. He helped him set it up. And they used this club called Limelight. And that was owned by Peter Gation. Now, when you watch videos of them and they're on Geraldo or I forgot what other ones. I don't know if it was Jenny Jones or something else, but you'll see Peter Gage in there, and he just looks like a total ass. He looks like he's just...
Well, he has an eye patch.
Very... Yes. They would. He would start promoting these parties for Gation, and Peter Gation was known as King of Clubs, and the early 90s treated him well for a while. He had the clubs Limelight, Palladium, Club USA, and Tunnel. He was making a ton of money, more than $1 million a week sometimes, but Peter ran into some problems later that we'll get into, but just for now, it's just good to know that he was known as King of the Clubs and that Michael pretty much promoted for him. James was extremely influential in Michael's life. Later, we'll talk a little bit more about what James actually did after the tragic event, which he made money off of. Not sure like how I feel about that part of it either.
And that was that book, right? The Bloodbath book or whatever?
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure he probably made money off of the movie, too, I bet.
Do you think so? I don't know. Well, maybe just, like, off of his image, at least, like, for them using his name and whatnot.
Maybe. I was just like, wow, this dude's profited off a book and a movie, probably. Well, I know, I want to say the shockumentary was also either made by him or he was very much... had a lot to do with it.
I did see, because I looked up his name just to see exactly like what he is famous for now.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, like, if you look him up on Google, it just says Jane St. James is a television personality and author, celebutante, which is actually like a name on Google, which kind of blew my mind. Frequent collaborator with Matthew Anderson and former club kid. And when you look down at his books, there's Disco Bloodbath, there's Freak Show, which I don't know if that is, I don't think that has any relation to this. But if you do look at movies, it does say Party Monster, Party Monster, the Shockumentary. Mm-hmm. Let me look at the IMDb. I'm not sure if that's just because his likeness is used or if he did. Let me see if he produced it or anything. Well,
okay.
So it says the movie Party Monster is based off of the book Disco Bloodbath.
Okay, so he would have had to make money off of that then, yeah?
Yeah, he has writing credits on it.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Wow. Yeah, so he... Huh. I bet he made a pretty good penny.
That's interesting. I wonder how much that movie made.
Yeah, I don't know. You're the master on finding that stuff out.
Well, it was a $5 million movie, and it made... It did not even make $1 million at the box office, so I don't think James St. James made a lot of money off of that.
Wow. That's kind of, I don't know. I was not expecting that.
To be fair, actually, no, James St. James probably did make money off of this because he just has writing credits as he wrote the book, they used the book for the movie, so he didn't really have anything to do with the movie, like, production-wise and whatnot, so he probably still did get residuals or at least a one-time payment for letting them use the book for the movie.
Wow.
But that was a bomb. That movie bombed.
Yeah, and I wasn't expecting that because I think I remember at the time that seemed to be a pretty popular movie. I just never did get around to watching it. And maybe,
I think it might be because it's 2003 Macaulay Culkin. Like, how much did people really care about Macaulay Culkin by 2003?
Yeah. Yeah, and they might not have known it was based off a true crime, true story either.
No, it just kind of looks like a fun movie.
Yeah, it does. So, the club kids consisted of not only James St. James, but you had Julie Jules, DJ Kaoki, and Ernie Glam. And that's kind of how it started. But when the club kids started growing, you had Amanda Lepore, you had Gitzy.
RuPaul.
Yes, RuPaul. That is, oh my gosh. I love seeing RuPaul in the videos.
The YouTube videos with RuPaul are the most fun thing in the world.
I know.
So fucking sassy, especially when they're on Geraldo Rivera.
Yes.
Oh my god. Isn't it great? And I can't remember who it was. I don't think it was not RuPaul. It was someone else. But there was one thing where they said some sassy ass comment to some, or Geraldo said some sassy ass comment to someone, and they were like, "Hey, Geraldo, I heard you changed your name a while ago." And I was like, "Fucking get him!
Oh my god!
Period. Get Gerald Rivers out of here."
Oh my god, I love it. So fucking good. Yeah, and there was one where like. It was so kind of sad, though, because there was one that I watched where they were at this gallery. They were walking to this gallery, and it was RuPaul and Nelson and some other guys that I didn't really know. But these homophobes start peeking their head in through the door, and it just looks so uncomfortable because you see how confident RuPaul is today, and you look back at... you know, baby RuPaul, and you're seeing kind of what he had to go through, and just, I don't know, that brought some real human feelings, like, oh my gosh, this person is just a person. This isn't just some celebrity. Like, look at how crappy people treated him, and it's like he wasn't sassy back to them or anything like that, and it's not what I would think RuPaul would be today. He was just completely kind of speechless and just kind of standing there like a little lamb. And I felt so bad.
Yeah, dude.
And I was like, wow, I would have not expected that.
I think that's what a lot of people don't realize. Like, they just see someone who came up and they're like, oh, look at them. They're just so better than the world and they're just a dick, this, that, blah, blah. And it's like, no, people go through their own shit and they've probably gone through a lot to get to the point that they are. Yeah. And that's why at this point they're like, you know what? I'm not taking any shit from you. I'm not dealing with this. I've been through my bullshit. Fuck you. Mm-hmm. Like, I made it, bitch. Here we are.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Man. And I can see that in RuPaul. Like, RuPaul never has to ask for anything, and you know, ever again. RuPaul never has to work ever again.
Have you seen his house? That's a $13 million fucking bad bitch home.
I have not seen RuPaul's house, but now I definitely need to see what it looks like. But
it is insane.
But, you know, I don't know. I've always felt a little different about RuPaul, though, because I've always felt this realness about RuPaul. But it's like, you really see where that comes from now, especially when you watch these videos. You'll see like the 80s and early 90s of RuPaul and kind of how he came up. But Ru does not acknowledge Michael, like, ever. And now Michael, when he got out of prison a little later, he does come out with Ernie Glam, and they have this kind of podcast / YouTube channel kind of thing together. I think it was like for Ernie to try to help Michael keep his mind on something and keep him focused on something. But they had this channel called The Pew, and it's still up, and you can go through, there's just a rabbit hole.
There's over 500 episodes. There's so many episodes. And the worst thing about it, like, it would have been easier for me to listen to them, and I really hate to be that picky person.
Yeah.
But the sound quality is just fucking abysmal I could not do it. I was like, and then I tried to see, I was like, okay, maybe after 400 episodes, they get a couple mics or something. And there's still no mics. And I was like, okay, I can't fucking listen to this. Like, I can't do it. And then it's just like, it's just so like, it's kind of fun. But at the same time, it's Michael and, wait, what was his name again?
Ernie Glam.
Ernie. Yeah, Ernie Glam. They're just like, they're kind of like fun, but they're like your narcissistic friend that you can only listen to for like so long, and then you're like, I can't stand this anymore. But it's just like all the time, and you don't know them. So I was like, I can't fucking listen to this.
Yeah, I totally get it. Like, it's definitely not for everyone, and it is It's difficult to kind of get started, but when they start mentioning other people's names, I think that's where they kind of kept me, because they would talk about things that I kind of had already looked up or whatever. And, you know, I get what Ernie was doing was to try to be a positive influence on Michael.
Did you see that last episode he posted? Like right after yes. Michael died, he posted that video about yes. Michael's death. And that was another one of the things that made me fairly sad. But it also made me feel like, I don't know, there's like two sides of it. Because, you know, like there's those people that have these problematic friends that never cut them off, that never like do anything about it. And they just like kind of let them do their thing. They're like, well, they're my friends, so I have to be there for them. I kind of got some of that. Yeah. But then I also got like, you know what? It kind of seems fairly real, too. And like, I don't know, like this... I feel like a shitty person,
totally
kind of, for feeling bad for this guy, but at the same time, no. I find myself feeling bad for him sometimes, and I don't know if I'm in the wrong or in the right here, but I don't know.
See, I don't either, and I'm glad that, I thought you were for sure gonna come in this saying, like, no, fuck him, you know, it still is what it is, which, that is true, and I get
that side, too. I get
people,
both sides, because there's the side
yeah,
where
totally.
Someone was murdered, their family has to deal with that and whatnot. But there's another side where, and I mean, we're going to get into it, but I'm just going to kind of poke it in there a little bit. It
kind of
seemed like self-defense, and we don't have enough stories on this guy,
yeah.
Angel, in general. Like, there are
true.
Stories, but they're all so conflicting. There were even, did you see that documentary where, I can't remember which character it was, or not character, but, you know, actual person, just character as in, you know, characters welcome.
Yeah.
But they even said as far, like, if anyone should have died, it should have been Angel. They were like, Angel deserved to die. They were like, he's a terrible fucking person. And then I'm like, what the fuck? And that's crazy. Like, you don't, there was one show that I listened to that made a really good point. I don't remember. I think it was a YouTube video, like Mystery, but I don't know. It's like, if you look at Michael Alec, it's one of the only like podcasts on YouTube about it. But they made a really good point, and they were like, you know, usually when you hear these like firsthand accounts of like people that knew the victim and whatnot, and especially when someone is murdered in such a horrendous way, they usually have something nice to say about them. But the fact that it's so conflicting, and that someone even said like, no, he was a terrible, evil fucking person and he deserved to die, is just, it's so weird. And then, you know, I'm just going to spoil a little bit again. Sorry that I ruined the narrative.
No, you're good. No.
Stop.
You're good.
Quit apologizing, Paige. I'm doing it either way. So, when they start talking about this, like it just. Oh, now I lost my train of thought because you apologized. How dare you? You piece of shit. Hold on. I'm getting it back. It almost seems like this whole thing was in self-defense, because when it all happened, like, there was a drug dispute, which obviously seems like a problem, and who knows what's fucking going down within, like, when that's happening. Like, you're never gonna get the full truth out of people, I'm sure. But from what it seems like, and it doesn't seem like there's any physical evidence that says otherwise, it seems like Angel did attack him and started choking him, and then the other, Freeze, Mr. Riggs, hit Angel over the head with a hammer. And then, you know, I mean, obviously it got pretty crazy after that, but there is that one side of everything where it's like, they are these club kids, they're synonymous for doing drugs and everything. They obviously do not like police. They don't want to call the police at any cost, even when someone was murdered. So obviously I don't condone, you know, them putting him into a bathtub and keeping him there for a week and then chopping him up and throwing him in a river and all those things. But it's like, I don't know. I do also see the mania of everything,
right,
and I don't know if I will put him in the same category as other vicious murderers.
Exactly.
Because also, I mean, if you think about it, well, I guess it did get crazier too, but I mean, in the beginning, it didn't even start out with Michael attacking him. I mean, Michael technically didn't do it. Freeze hit him with the hammer, but then again, you get into the Drano in the mouth and all that, and that's where it gets a little weird again. You're like, okay, but again, I don't know. It could be that mania, and I feel so bad even trying to defend someone who chopped someone up and, like, did all this, but it's just, it's so weird.
No, I get it. It's such a thing on YouTube now, when you go and look at any of the videos, whether it's on The Pew or it's on Nelson's old videos that somebody put out there, because Nelson died on July the 3rd, I think, 1989. So someone found Nelson's videos and started putting them out there. And you'll go under there and look at the comments, and some of them are like, oh my gosh, you know, I feel like I've learned so much through these videos. And, you know, you have some people that are like, I hope they're both resting at peace. And then you've got the other side that's like, oh,
you're defending
fuck him,
a fucking,
you know,
murderer and blah, blah, blah. And
yeah. I think it's so much more complicated than that.
Yeah, it's so hard because even when I'm looking at those YouTube comments, I find myself kind of like feeling for both sides. I'm like, no, you're right, but also you're right. I'm like, I get it. Like, they legitimately, the club kids seemed like they made a really incredible scene that, I mean, that also was spawned by Michael Alec. It wouldn't have been a thing without him. Not saying that, you know, you can't, I mean, obviously you could be a terrible person, still do great things. I mean, that happens all the time, but it's just such a strange thing. Well, even in the beginning of, you know, him starting the club kids and doing everything, he didn't even do drugs for a long time. And we didn't even get into his boyfriend yet, DJ Keoki.
So DJ Keoki was one of the original club kids. He was kind of brought into the scene by Michael, I think.
He was. He was brought into the scene by Michael because Michael was going out. He was looking for like a boyfriend for the night or for the time being in general, something of the sort. And then Michael found Keoki, and Keoki said the story. He was like, yeah, you know, I was a straight guy. I was out there looking for a girl. Then Michael came up to me with a drink ticket, and then he just kind of like persuaded me a little bit. And then I ended up going with him. And then Michael was like, well, you're my boyfriend now. And he was like, all right, I guess I'm your boyfriend. And then he ended up this is so weird too, because I'm like, was this like, did Michael just help him come out, or was he kind of just like going with it? Like, remember in Tiger King, like it always made, thinking about like that side of it where like some gay guy just comes by like fucking, what's the Tiger King's name again? I forget his name. Joe Exotic.
Yeah.
So like someone like Joe Exotic will come around and be like, hey, you're gay. You're my boyfriend now. And some people will be like, oh, well, I guess you have stuff I want. So sure. I guess I'm gay and I have a boyfriend now. It seems like that's what happened to Keoki.
It could very well be. You know, it was kind of awkward to see him on episodes of The Pew because he kind of looked like maybe he didn't want to be there.
Oh my god. He looked like Riff Raff mixed with Pauly D. It blew my fucking mind.
Yes.
I was like, wait, what is going on, Keoki? Like, I just watched these movies with you and you have this nice little haircut. He almost looked like in the Party Monster movie, he looked like Fez from that 70s show.
Yes.
And then I see like him in real life, like on the Pew episodes, and I was like, wait, dude.
Are something He's like
else.
Buff and everything. He like, I don't know. It's so funny. He does. He looks like a Guido.
It is insane. A Guido with a grill.
Yes.
He doesn't have a grill, but he looks like he would have a grill.
Yes, for sure. Oh my god. Oh my god, that is so true.
I loved it. And you know what's crazy too? We started talking for a second about famous club kids. There was one video I watched because there's so many talk shows with the club kids. Like, there is an insane amount. They were on Geraldo like probably like 10 different fucking times. They were on fucking Colbert, they're on a bunch of shit.
Mm-hmm.
And Colbert. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm gonna call it Colbert. That's fine.
Yeah, that's
anyway.
Good.
Anyway. You know, sometimes it's so weird. Sometimes I do that on purpose and then sometimes I do it on accident. And when I do it on purpose, I'm like, it's fine, but then when I do it on accident, I feel the need to correct myself. I'm like, I should just play that off like it was on purpose because I do it all the time. Anyway, there was another person in this. In one of these videos, I think it was a Geraldo episode, but it was pretty much like all these Geraldo episodes are just Geraldo like trying to find straight people in the crowd of club kids going like, hey, or do you feel weird that you're straight or do you feel like an abomination, this, that, blah, blah, blah. And then he looks at the gay people. He's like, you're bad, too. And then he tries to get like people with suits to like, you know, kind of go and get. It's just like a whole controversy thing. They just want people to attack each other in the crowd. But at one point he looks at he keeps looking at them, too. And he also does this thing where he's like, are you guys going to be successful after this? Like, what are you going to do? Blah, blah, blah. And he looks at one person in the crowd and she's like, I already am successful. I'm an actress. And then he's like, okay, what's your name? What have you been in? And she says, my name is Lisa Gay from the Toxic Avengers series. And I was looking at her too. And I was like, wait, she looks so familiar. Yeah. And then she said Toxic Avenger. And I was like, oh my God, That is literally the Lisa Gay from fucking Toxic Avenger. And I was like, this, and she was just sitting there with her hair looking all beautiful in this, I think she was wearing kind of like a fucking suit kind of thing, but like a feminine suit. And then she just had these badass glasses on and just sat there looking like such a fucking bad bitch. She was just like, yeah, no. She was like, I back these kids. I'm a part of this. I fucking do movies. I do this shit. And I was like, this bitch is literally sitting out here looking like a complete bad bitch talking about doing like trauma movies and all this. And I'm like, this is fucking great. Like, I love everything about it.
Yeah. And a lot of people might know Lady Bunny today. She was also a part of the club kids scene back then. There was another one that comes up in the movie is Christina. And you were talking about how people kind of reacted to deaths and things like that. Christina died 10 days before Nelson. And so Christina in the movie is played by Marilyn Manson. And so I went on this journey to like, okay, I want to know more about Christina. And I don't know. I think she had schizophrenia, but also she was like really messed up on drugs all the time. But in one of the videos that I watched earlier today, Christina had just died like 2 days before the video. And Nelson was like, did you hear about Christina? And they're all going on this bus to Washington, D.C. And somebody said, no, when is she coming? And Nelson goes, oh, she's dead. And it's just like they just kind of, you know, they had that dark sense of humor that they said they had to have back then because, unfortunately, people were passing away from AIDS, like, left and right back then. And they just had to have this kind of dark humor to cope with deaths from drugs and AIDS. And that's so sad, but it kind of made me giggle, and I felt bad. But I was like, oh my gosh, just to have humor during that time. It's just wild.
Well, yeah, in the movie, Michael was kind of like laughing at it, and then he kind of makes a joke where he's like, oh, you know, well, she shouldn't have fucking died when she knew I had a party going.
Yes,
you know,
One of Michael's best friends in the club scene was Robert Riggs, who is better known as Freeze. And like we've been saying, I mean, they all pretty much abused drugs heavily. Like, Michael did not use at all in the beginning, but when he did start using, it was like he didn't know what the limit was. There was no limit.
And did the movie kind of over-exaggerate it, or did he start using drugs because of him and Keoki?
You know, I don't really know when the drug abuse really started to happen with Michael. You just all the time, like in all of the interviews and stuff that I've seen, like James St. James and others, they'll just be like, well, you know, he got wrapped up in the scene and it just happened. But they would all say, you know, he didn't used to be in drugs at all, but it was just kind of like it went along with the party and he just, I don't know if it was like it helped him be more out there with people. Since he was from such a small town, I don't know if this kind of helped him communicate with people and not be as socially kind of awkward. But for some, I don't know when he exactly started using or why, but I don't know. And it's sad because he didn't know his limit. And even like when he does his crime and he goes to prison, in his prison interviews, you can tell like that just, you can tell he's already got like effects of what could be mental illness and drugs at the same time. Kind of the way his brain was just not functioning on all cylinders to me. It was just really
crazy.
I'm
not one to diagnose someone, but he definitely seems like he probably has like some kind of schizophrenic tendencies and whatnot because he's kind of going off and the drug use definitely doesn't help. And I'm pretty sure in all of those prison interviews, he was probably high for all of those as well, because he did interviews where he said he was in solitary confinement for 5 years because he kept doing heroin and they kept testing him for heroin and he kept turning up positive while in solitary. So there was never a time where he was not doing drugs.
Yeah, never. And except I think maybe when he got out and he was on parole and Ernie was trying to take care of him through that time. But even then, he was like, in 2016 or so, things started going downhill, and he backed away from Michael a lot. And he just said, you know, his drug use just got to be too much again, and we did cut off our relationship. And he handed over the pew to Michael at one point, and Michael did it on his own. You mentioned Ernie's video after Michael passed, and what's so crazy is that is when I found the channel right before, like a week or two before he died. I had just found the channel, and I don't even know why I subscribed to it and clicked the bell, because I wasn't even expecting a video to ever come out. And then, like a day or two after Michael died, I saw the notification of the Pew posted whatever the title of it is, and I was like, oh no. So I ran straight there to watch it, and it was really sad. Him and Breeze, they were doing drugs heavily. They were roommates, and their drug dealer was Angel Melendez.
And he was also living with them.
Yeah, he was living with them off and on. And that's the thing that kind of got me while I was researching this, is that some places would mention that they were living together, and then other places would make it seem like Angel was just dropping by for a visit. And I'm like, okay, was he living there full time, or was it just kind of an off and on stay in here kind of thing?
From what I got, I'm pretty sure Angel kind of just stayed there or hung out there a lot time to time while he was still working at the nightclub. But after a while, and I'm pretty sure it was the Limelight, maybe it was a different nightclub at this point, but I'm pretty sure it was the Limelight. He was working for the Limelight specifically as a drug dealer under, Eyepatch's
Peter
name
Gation?
Again? Under Peter Gation. Yeah. But then Peter Gation started to get sketched out because, you know, the FBI was watching him. He saw, like, cars taking him out and whatnot. So he ended up firing all the drug dealers, which included Angel. And then, from my understanding, that's when Angel started living with Michael full-time.
Okay. Yeah, and, man, I don't want to paint a horrible picture of Angel, because I say he's a drug dealer, but obviously there's more to everybody than what they do. And, you know, people can be the greatest people in the world, and you just go down a path that you didn't even want to go down. I mean, I'm sure people don't set out to be sex workers, drug dealers, or anything like that. So I don't want that to stain his name or anything.
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey man, we all sell drugs at one point or another. I sold drugs from like 14 to 18 or 19 or some shit like that.
I mean,
that was my job for a while.
Fast money, you know?
Yeah, man. I mean, shit, I was living on top of the world with, like, you know, $100 profit a week.
Yeah, for real. I mean, yeah, at that age too, it's like, what more could you ask for? And you know, it's fast money, and especially when they're trying to help themselves, like, for rent or whatever it is. I mean, that fast money, it really works.
All right, Paige, stop telling people to be drug dealers.
That'll be the next thing. We're condoning all this
stuff. He was over here talking about fast money. All right, guys, go be a drug dealer.
Or a sex worker, you know. But yeah, obviously these jobs are super dangerous to be doing, and I don't know what I would do if I was in the position where somebody was like, okay, you can't work here, you're getting turned down for jobs everywhere. And, like, you look around, like, what else can I do? I've been let down for all these other jobs. Nothing else is working. So Angel kind of falls into this category. You know, he loves the club scene. He probably just got wrapped up in the lifestyle. And plus, he's thinking, well, I get to party with my friends and, like, be in good company with them, as well as have them be my customers. So it was working for him for a while. So Angel moved to New York all the way from Columbia when he was only 8. And I really couldn't find much on him growing up other than he met Peter Gation and started selling drugs, like you said, in his nightclubs, working for him. And he wore those huge feathered angel wings on his back. He was honestly like a really beautiful man. He really was. He was really pretty.
The angel wings just make me, and this is a bad joke, you could edit it out if you want, but the angel wings just really make me think of, like, when someone dies and they, like, edit them with angel wings and, like, clouds and shit.
Yes, oh, but that is true. Okay, see? Yeah, they do look kind of like those photoshopped angel wings.
And I'm mainly mentioning it because I saw a couple pictures of Angel like that, and I was like, you really did him dirty.
Oh my gosh. Now I'm not going to be able to, like, not think of it that way, but I mean, he was a beautiful man. And
it's so fucking weird. And to what you're saying about, you know, like, not being able to find much background on him, that's what happens with a lot of these drug dealers that are in this lifestyle, because they leave home at an early age, they cut off all ties, they don't really communicate with them, so their family kind of, you know, quote-unquote forgets about them to an extent, yeah. And then, you know, there's not really anything to go off of.
Yeah, and that's really upsetting, too, when you come across cases like this, or sex workers, and it's like you've got all these victims and, like, a sentence about each one of them. And it's just so sad. At the time that Michael and Angel met, Michael was already being dubbed, like, king of the club kids, and he was a prominent buyer of Angel's drugs, and he introduced Angel into the club scene. Freeze and Michael, they were roommates, and Michael was dating DJ Keoki. Angel was in the mix, so they're all living together, partying together. They're taking drugs, like, not only at the club, but they're using it for their personal use, like, away from the clubs now, too. It's, like, nonstop. They don't know their limit. We talked a little bit about DJ Keoki. If you watch the movie, you'll kind of see, like, their relationship. And it is based on James St. James's book, Disco Bloodbath. So you'll see the relationship between Michael and Keoki. He was born in El Salvador, and he moved to Maui as a young child. And after high school, he went to an airline school in California. And he worked a little while with several airlines in New York after that. And then he started working as a busboy at the Danceteria Club. And that's how he started making his way into DJing. And he said, quote, "I kept bugging a nearby club manager to please, please, please let me DJ there. And I told him I knew how to do it, even though I only had a small collection of records and one turntable at home. He let me play a lounge gig on some of the slower nights, and he told me to play whatever the fuck you want, so long as they stay." And he said those are words that he's continued to live by.
This is so off topic, but it's just so weird. I'm just looking at, like, RuPaul's Wikipedia, and, like, it shows early life and a lot of stuff like that, and everything starts right after the Club Kids. That is so weird that even the Wikipedia doesn't acknowledge it, though. It's like, it's just, you can find videos of RuPaul involved with the Club Kids and everything, but it's just not anywhere else.
And Ru will not acknowledge Michael at all. Now, in some of the Pew videos, Michael kind of gets a little cocky, and Michael kind of alludes to the fact that, oh, I made RuPaul. Like, oh, I made RuPaul who RuPaul is. And I'm just like, well, that's a bold statement. That's a bold statement. But RuPaul has never, to my knowledge, ever even spoke Michael's name.
Yeah. I did see at some point, and I didn't watch the episode, so I don't know if they mentioned it at all, but RuPaul does have a podcast, and I saw in one episode, it was titled The Club Kids, but I don't know what they spoke of in the episode.
Now, I did watch, well, I listened to one this morning, and I thought it was Michelle Visage's podcast, or either she was on maybe RuPaul's at the time. This was like 3 years ago, and he talked about Nelson, but as far as anybody else, he really wouldn't touch on any other names besides Lady Bunny. So that's how DJ Kaoki kind of came into the scene, and they struck up a romantic relationship, Michael and DJ Kaoki, and he started DJing at Disco 2000 parties. And this is when Michael slowly started to change, and things at the parties became a little more obscure, kind of macabre in theme, as his drug use got heavier. During the end of those party years, there were parties that were called like emergency room party, gore party, and it just got extremely darker in each theme.
Well, the gore parties were fucking disgusting, because I think it was James St. James who said that he was, like, laying on a table with, like, raw liver on him, and it started, like, smelling and shit, and I was like, that's just fucking gross.
Like, what did he say? That's in the shockumentary, by the way, which you can find on YouTube. But he said something like it started to smell, and he thought that flies were going to start getting like attracted to him or something. He said it was just so bad, and those pictures looked like it looked so real. Michael was doing heroin, Rohypnol, which is a date rape drug. He was doing those the most, along with cocaine, ecstasy, ketamine. It was reported that they were all just, like, constantly stuck in this K-hole. I think Michael Musto was probably one that reported that. And he was heavy with the club kids back then, too. And I remember him prominently because of MTV. I kind of grew up watching him report on music news. And to see him and be, like, one of the big focal points of this group, it was just really, really wild. And some of the things that he wrote, I think it's called The Voice.
That's who it was. Michael Musto was the one who called Geraldo Rivera out for his name. It was him for sure. I couldn't remember who it was, and now it's coming back to me. Yeah, it was definitely him.
It was just so weird that he was so prominent during that time, and
he's been around forever.
Yeah. It's wild. And it just brought back a lot of memories when I saw his face. I'm like, oh my God, that's the dude that I used to watch on MTV all the time. And he also would write articles about the club kids, and he didn't always have the nicest things to say, and he was never really shy about it, but he wrote, his columns were pretty much straight up and kind of harsh at times, but so all these drugs were being used. They were stuck in a constant K-hole. Things were just going really dark really fast. Michael acted manic depressive one minute, suicidal the next. He was physically, emotionally, mentally getting more sick. And people saw this, like he was getting sicker in every way as time went on. You had some people that were saying that, oh my gosh, we're scared that Michael's gonna kill himself, but other people were like, oh, he's too narcissistic, he'll never do that. But everyone kind of saw him changing minute to minute. It was mental and it was like drug. So one of the things that I heard today, they really made it okay to have a group of people where you have several mental illnesses going on, but you're still accepted for who you are. So you had like, it was kind of like they were normalizing like having mental illness and still having this like tight-knit group of people that you could still party with and be with all the time. And
yeah, sounds like everyone in my city.
Yeah. I think doing all these drugs and being mentally unwell, that's not really going to make your decisions super smart. So, the Limelight Club, where Michael threw his parties, like you mentioned, a few months, the club got shut down because it was suspected that there was drug dealing going on inside. Angel, Michael, and others had been working at Limelight since the early 80s, and it was like their home was being shut down. Because, I mean, that's what they pretty much called their home. And what happened next it wouldn't fare well in Peter Gation's favor when it came to suspicions of drugs being sold at his club, because this pretty much verified it. On March 17th, 1996, it was a Sunday, and Angel went over to Michael and Freeze's Riverbank West apartment. Everything that went down in that apartment, like you said, it's only been talked about by Freeze and Michael since they were the only ones who were there. So we do get conflicting reports sometimes because Michael's changed his story over the years, like on camera and off.
No, Paige. Michael changes his story every single time he talks about his story. Like, there are so many different times where he's mentioned it, and it's always completely different, which is another one of the parts that gets me like, I don't know, bud.
Yeah, I know. Every time, you're right. I mean, it's so sad, too, because there's one point on the pew when somebody comes over, and they're wanting Michael to take accountability. And I can't remember which friend it was. I feel like I'm supposed to know this, but one of them comes over and they're like, just, can you really just say you're sorry? And he genuinely looks confused. Damn. Like, he still can't mentally grasp that he did something wrong. There's just so much with Michael's mental that I feel like is not there sometimes. And I don't know. If you watch him, that's why I asked you to watch him, because I was like, just watch a few of these and see kind of like what you think about his mental state, or, you know, drugs being compared to somebody who might not be in the best mental health, because this is just such a hard one for me.
I mean, Michael is a fucking class A narcissist. He has a lot of drug issues. He definitely has some other mental problems, whether it's depression, maybe even a little bit of schizophrenia or something. Like, there is something going on in that dude's brain that is not right.
Yeah, I totally agree. Now, like we said, there's conflicting things about what happened. Of course, James St. James in the movie Party Monster, things get kind of misconstrued, but I found an interview where Michael said that what happened in the movie is actually what happened. So this is going to be kind of crazy, but Angel goes to the apartment that day, and supposedly him and Michael are arguing over Angel saying, well, Michael, you owe me money because you've been buying all these drugs from me, and now, you know, you owe it to me now, I guess. You know, it's kind of like, okay, I've given you enough time.
Well, the way it went down in the movie was that Angel, like, left for the day or something, and Michael and Freeze did all of his drugs without asking him, and then they were like, hey, you gotta give me more drugs, and he was like, what the fuck are you talking about? And he was like, well, you know, you don't even pay rent, so, you know, give me more drugs. He's like, you've done, like, thousands of dollars worth of drugs.
Yeah.
Which I could see happening.
That, yeah, I was going to say, and that seems like...
Seems accurate. Know,
it definitely could have happened. You can't rule it out because we only have two people that were really there besides Angel that really know. And Michael's story was different every time, and I couldn't really find out a lot about Freeze.
No.
As far as, like, interviews or anything while he was in prison. Like, I couldn't find anything like that.
Didn't he get lesser of a sentence, too?
I think so. I have it in here, but,
which is
kind of crazy
to me, because I'm like, I don't know where the line goes. Like, okay, Freeze hit him with a hammer, Michael Drano'd him, and then Freeze kept it hidden, and then knew that Michael was cutting him up, and then they went together, right, to get rid of the body when they dropped the box in the river. It was the Hudson River, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I kind of feel like they're both pretty much in part on that, which kind of weirded me out.
Yeah, okay. So like you said, I believe that definitely could have happened. It wouldn't surprise me. That definitely could be how things went down, is how it was portrayed in the movie. But either way, things got physical. Allegedly, Angel was stronger than Michael, and he was choking him, and Michael started yelling out for help. Well, Freeze runs over with a hammer. He bust Angel over the head three times and said, until he said that Angel went down.
Oh, I didn't know it was three times. That, see, that changes a lot of things, too. I thought he hit him one time. Okay, see, that changes things, too, especially for the free side of things. If he hit him once, that's one thing, but it goes into a different thing when you hit someone and you continue to hit them. Huh. Yeah.
And Michael has said during interviews in the pew with Ernie Glam that he was so messed up on drugs that he can't remember all of the details in the incident very well, which, you know, I don't know if it's just like the amount of drugs.
I don't think that's accurate.
Yeah.
Because then later in other interviews, he starts talking about certain details.
Yes,
it's like,
that's
okay,
what confuses
bud.
Me. Like, you're one minute you're saying you don't really remember, but the other times, like, you're going into details about other things. And you're saying the story one way. I mean, it's always different with Michael. And it's like, you can never really tell when Michael's being serious. And that's pretty much how he gets away with this for so long, too.
Well, he gets away with it, but he also has this weird thing where, like, he needs to tell everyone about it. Like, he tells them about it, but then they kind of think he's joking.
Yeah, that's what I say. Like, you know, you never can tell when he's being serious, and that just pretty much goes to show you right there, like, his friends couldn't either. They couldn't tell, like, okay, is this the Michael that is joking and trying to make dark humor out of things, or should we actually be looking at, like, nobody really knew what to make of that. What gets me is, instead of calling the cops, which I guess it really doesn't, like, blow me that much for a loop, because I know they didn't really want to have a lot to do with the cops, but, you know, they started to smother Angel with either a towel, a sweatshirt, or a pillow. Those stories change, too.
Yeah.
And they've told so much, I'm not 100% sure what...
Well, even the Drano thing gets weird, because apparently, like, Michael's admitted that there was one interview where I watched where they asked him, they're like, hey, so in the movie Party Monster, you guys put Drano into a syringe and then injected him with Drano, and they're like, did that happen? He's like, no. And they're like, well, did you put Drano in his mouth and then put duct tape over it? He's like, yeah, we did that. And apparently that's while Angel was still alive. So the Drano probably killed him.
This is from a 2006 interview, and it's from Jonathan Van Meter, posted in November of 2006, and it had been 10 years since the murder that took place, and it says that Freeze, according to his written confession to the police, grabbed a hammer from the closet and hit Angel over the head, trying to knock him unconscious so he would stop strangling Michael. Well, from this point, the details are hazy, and it says Alig may or may not have tried to inject Drano into Angel's veins. He may or may not have poured Drano into his mouth and taped it shut. He may or may not have invited friends over to party while the corpse sat in a trunk, which, yes, and I do believe that, because...
That I believe. Because there were other people that said, like, they came over and they were just resting their foot on a box in the middle of the room, and that had Angel's body in it.
And I have to believe that is true, because there are more than a couple of accounts of this box being in the living room. But yeah, and they're just sitting there doing the drugs while Angel's, like, right there and nobody knows it. It just blows my mind. Even for him to be in a bathroom and nobody knew it is wild to me.
Yeah. Because I thought a lot of people lived here, so I think that whole thing is very weird. Like, did they just lock the bathroom for, like, a week?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too. I'm like, okay, you know people are coming in and out, and now you have to, you know, tell them, oh, our bathroom is not working.
Yeah.
Like, what?
But you know what? That's probably fairly believable.
Yeah. What is very clear is that Michael and Freeze eventually put Angel's body in the bathtub and leaned a mattress against the bathroom door while they spent a week inside in a drug stupor trying to figure out what to do. And as the smell just started to get unbearable, they made their plan to dismember Angel's corpse. And it says that Freeze provided him with the sharp knives and 10 bags of heroin to get the job done.
Well, also, they left the body in the bathtub with, like, Drano and a bunch of other different things just mixed in. And I remember listening to one thing where Michael said, he was like, oh, yeah, Freeze didn't want to cut up the body, so I went and did it. And he was like, it was kind of just like butter. Like, it just all came right off. Like, the bones just went right through the bones and everything. And that's the part where I'm leaning more toward Michael being a fucking psychopath.
Yeah, yeah. Here's where I start getting too deep and trying to understand way too much about a person that could do something like this. And this is where I wanted to, you know, break it down and ask you, unless you didn't want to, you know, answer it. But I know we've both been kind of struggling with how we feel about this. And I just want to debate this with somebody who's not afraid to say what they think or feel. When Freeze goes for the hammer and he hits Angel instead of just physically removing Angel off of Michael after he hits him, Angel's still alive. Okay, they don't call the cops, maybe because of fear. I think in that scene, nobody pretty much ever called the cops because you've got drugs, number one. And then number two, it's like, then you have to try to get the cops to even believe you. Michael had abused so many hardcore drugs at this point, along with, you know, like we've been talking about, like his mental state and stuff. We don't know, but we know that everything has drastically changed. Not to mention the amount of drugs in his system when this all happened. So,
what's the question, Paige?
Do you think that he maliciously smothered Angel and intended to murder him, or could it have been like his mind was just so far gone that he didn't know what the hell he was even doing?
I have an answer. I think it's both. I think that it is such a perfect storm of events that there's two sides to it. Like, okay, the way I see it, and I had to think about this for a while, but I've came to the conclusion that I think the beginning of the story, where, you know, they did all their drugs, Angel is understandably pissed, Angel takes it too far, he starts choking Michael, Freeze comes in and hits him with a hammer to get him off of him because he's worried that Michael is going to be killed. I think that all of that right there is excusable, and I personally think that every single thing that happens after that is not excusable, but there is also a part of it where I understand how it all led to what it did, because one of those things where you find yourself in a shitty situation, not to say that this is an average situation or this could just happen to any given person or like, you know, oh, it's a fluke, but I can see that just like any other situation where things just kind of like go out of hand and you can't control it exactly. I think it started out fucked up. They could have fixed it, but there's just so many other little pieces of this puzzle that scared them and they decided to take matters in their own hands. But that, even with all that being said, it gets to that point where it's too far, you know, like right after Freeze hit him once, they continued to hit him, they realized he was alive, they obviously should have called someone, they should have figured something out, they should have, and it's even to say, you know, if they didn't want to call the cops, they could have even waited till Angel woke up. But then there's also that side where, okay, you just hit a drug dealer in the head with a hammer, this guy might just try to kill you now, he was already trying to kill you, and then now you have to live with this for however fucking long. You're going to keep seeing this person unless you guys just flee town completely. There's going to be a target on your shoulder at all given times. We don't know what Angel's capable of or if he even is, but that could be a matter at hand. But the way I see it in general, it's just too far, you know, when you go to, when someone's still alive and then they start pouring Drano in his mouth and putting duct tape on his mouth and throwing him in a closet and whatnot, like, I don't know. I don't, like I said, it's a really confusing story because I don't know the guy, I don't know the other person, and we're never going to know the full story because of everything that else that went down. There's too much drugs involved, too many things that could incriminate them, even if it doesn't have to do with the murder. There's just too much going on that I don't know how to give my exact answer to this, but based off of everything that I have, I do think that at the end of this story, like, you know, I start feeling bad for Michael in the very beginning, but by the time I get to the end of this, he's in the wrong.
Yeah, and it's definitely not like we're sitting here trying to make excuses or anything like that. Or, you know, I would think people that listen to true crime podcasts or anything like that, they know already, I would hope, that we're not murder sympathizers or whatever. You know, people just like to say that kind of stuff, but that's the farthest thing.
Yeah, we're not on the side of the murderer, but obviously in any case, there are...
Yeah.
There's a different side to everything, and you do have to look at all facts to understand. Because, I mean, obviously, there are cases where people get wrongly accused, and I don't want to... And this easily, like, this could be one of those cases not exactly wrongly accused, because it's obviously in a weird little... There's a weird line on this one, but it's like, this guy could be... fairly innocent in the term, at least in the terms of the law, and obviously sometimes people get away with things, you know, legally, but they're still, like, it was like Casey Anthony shit like that, where you're like, look at her, and you're like, okay, you might have got away with this legally, but we all know you fucking did it. But this isn't really one of those cases, like, we do all know that he did it, he's admitted to doing it, but we don't know the full story, and we don't know how events transpired, and like the movie says, like the cases say, like everyone involved says, this really could be an act of self-defense that went too far, but at the same time, like, it is an act of self-defense that went too far, but I still don't know that, yeah, I can excuse exactly. it. I'm not going to say that he is on the same level as, like, Dahmer or Bundy or anyone else, but I don't know. I just, it's
and
a weird
I think
thing.
It's the fact that we don't know, like, he could have been struggling with schizophrenia and doing all these drugs, it's like your brain.
And that's what I'm talking about, like, in the eyes of the law. Like, he could have been struggling with a very bad mental illness that, in the eyes of, like, and not only just the law, but a lot of people, they could be like, oh, well, he was suffering from mental illness, he wasn't aware of what he was doing, blah, blah, blah. So it could be a case of that. Who knows? Did he need jail, or did he need a mental hospital? Because my question isn't whether or not he should be allowed to be in everyday society. My side of it is no, I don't think so. I think he should have been either maybe not in jail for the rest of his life, but at least in a mental hospital for the rest of his life, because he was obviously a danger to society. He was a danger to his friends. He was a danger to himself. So, I mean, I think he definitely needed some kind of rehabilitation. I just don't know that it was prison. I do think that what he did was heinous. My heart goes out to Angel's family and, you know, to everyone that loved him and whatnot, but I don't know that this was a case of this guy needed to go to jail for the rest of his life. I think he might have needed real mental help.
Yeah, for sure. I do agree with that, and that's an amazing point, because, you know, you can be in prison for all your life and still not get better. You know, I think some people really need that mental help. And I totally agree with that. I do. We don't know how the Drano was exactly used. Michael tells it different every time. Freeze's story has also changed. But it was either injected into Angel's veins. I've actually heard Michael say that it was. But I've also heard him, like you say, I mean, he says he poured it down his throat, duct taped his mouth shut, and later... I watched an interview where Michael says, no, they filled the bathtub with Drano or some kind of chemical. And then they put him in the bathtub and doused his body with ice. And then to help with the smell, they would spray Calvin Klein Eternity cologne on the body. And I'm just like, ugh.
Yeah, see, and all that stuff is where it gets too far, especially, like, I understand being scared and not knowing what to do, but when you have a body in your bathtub for a week, and then you're actively trying to hide the smell and trying to hide the fact that it's in there, that's when it's, like, obviously, maybe it wasn't premeditated at that point, but you're consciously aware of what is happening, and you were living that reality.
Mm-hmm. That is a good point. It probably was not at all premeditated, but at that point, you know... what is
it's
going
gone too
on.
Far.
Yeah.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew.
Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
So they ended up closing the door like it never happened. And like we were talking about, like the party happened. And people are saying there was a box in the room. Later, this box was full of Angel's body parts. Michael did the dismemberment. As far as I've heard the story go, it's kind of he was saying like Freeze couldn't do it, so he handed me all this heroin. I did it. I can't wrap my mind around how people dismember a body like at all. I can't wrap my mind around, like, you'd have to be hopped up on some serious drugs like that to do it, in my opinion. Like, and I just don't.
And they knew what they were doing, too, because they only, well, Michael, because it was Michael who cut up the body. He only cut off the leg, so they literally just cut him up just enough to fit him in the box.
Yes. Oh, God.
And then, so I'm going to go ahead, I'm sure you were getting into this, but I'm going to go ahead and spoil this next part. He pretty much, they decided they had to get rid of the body, so they have it in this box. It's in there for a while. Friends are leaning their legs on it and whatnot, and then they're finally like, okay, we have to get rid of this. So they call a cab. And when they get in this cab, they tell this guy, hey, we'll give you $20 to take us over to the Hudson River to throw this box in the river. And they're like, and the cabbie asks, hey, what's in the box? And they say, oh, it's just some old dishes and stuff we don't want. Cabbie did not question them, took the $20 and helped them throw it into the river. If I'm a fucking, I mean, nowadays it's Uber. If I'm a fucking Uber driver and you say, hey, take me over this river so I can throw a box away, I'd say, get the fuck out of my car. Don't. Get the fuck out of my car right now before I kill you. Are you kidding? Get the fuck away from me. I'm not getting involved in your bullshit.
Exactly. Yeah, that would be terrifying to me. Like,
I don't trust that cab.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to think that that cab driver either, like, knew who they were, or
maybe they just really needed $20, but I don't fucking know that I need that $20 that bad, dude.
So Michael would go around and he would say, you know, oh, I killed Angel. And he kind of thought that it would play into his favor, which it did, because he was so narcissistic that he couldn't keep it to himself. And I think he felt bad at the same time. It's like he wanted to get caught. But people just kind of blew it off like, oh, that's over the top Michael being who Michael is. And did you see that interview where he is like back in the day after Angel goes missing, he's on either this TV show or something for one of the clubs, and he's given an interview and he says, I killed Angel. And then he goes, oh, that was a bad joke.
Yeah, I did see that one actually.
I was like, whoa.
Fucking crazy.
And just to see that his eyes looked like he was just dead in the eyes during that, too. I don't know. I just feel like there was...
There's no remorse.
So during all this time, Angel's been reported as missing, and Michael and Freeze just go about their lives like nothing happened. The cops were not in a hurry to really find a drug dealer. And this is what we kind of talk about all the time. In a lot of cases, they don't try to find out who these sex workers are or who these drug dealers are or who their families are or anything like that. So they're not really looking for Angel.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but around the time when they got rid of the body with the box, they didn't put holes in the box, so the body did not sink. It floated, and it ended up going into a different territory, and a different police department actually found the body, and they assumed that it was like that it was a body that floated over from Cuba. Like, they were actually throwing out some insane theories because they were like, we don't know whose body this is. And it wasn't until, I think it was Michael Musto's article that was posted that they ended up finding the body and connecting it to Angel.
Okay, see, I was wondering how they actually connected the body as to who it was when it washed up. And that's a big piece that I was really missing, because after they dumped his body and everything, it was in March, and now it's September, and Michael's been making these flippant jokes and comments, and the police still haven't even interrogated Michael at this point, or Freeze, or anybody, and because the cops are more focused right now on Peter Gation dealing drugs out of his club.
Well, because at this time, this was when they ended up finding the body and whatnot, I believe. If my timeline is right, I believe this was around the time they found the body, and they started to put everything together, but they were like, hey, we don't really care about this guy. We just want to get this other dude down. Like, do you have information on him?
Yeah, that's exactly how it went. And in November, a coroner have reported that it was Angel Melendez. So that I was not really connecting the dots on how they found out it was Angel's body, because
it was all Michael Musto, from what I believe. He wrote an article.
You know, he was getting all the inside scoop.
Yeah. Michael kept saying that he killed Angel, Michael Alec kept saying that he killed Angel, and then Michael Musto was like, all right, I think this dude's being fucking serious and starting to creep me out. So he wrote an article about it, pretty much detailing everything that he heard and what he knew about it and whatnot. And then one of the cops in the other county found that article, and then they found out that they were like, because Michael even said he cut the legs off the body and put in a box and everything like that, and he put that into the article, and then they were like, hey, we have this legless body that we can't identify, and they were able to identify it off of that.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. And I guess in theory, like, when they said the box down the river, it would have, I don't remember where they said it would have floated to, but it actually would have went like all the way down the river and pretty much just been gone. But there were a lot of weather conditions and thunderstorms or whatnot that ended up making the box float to a different area where they found it.
I just wonder what would have happened if they wouldn't have, if his body never would have washed up. And I think it probably would have done Michael the same way. Honestly, I think it would have eaten at him the way it did when he went to prison. I mean, like you said, he didn't stop doing drugs.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't think he would have. I think it would have ended as it did, sadly or not sadly. I don't know. I don't want to say the wrong thing, but I mean, it's sad, because no matter what, those club kids, the original club kids, they're like a family. So to them, either way, it's sad that Michael is gone, because he was a part of their family too. So I get both sides of it, to where you just want to be like, oh, I hate this guy. But then again, you feel kind of bad for him. But it's things like this that he says in this interview that just make you want to wring his neck. While he was in prison, I think this says a lot to his character, his narcissistic mind, and everything. He said, quote, listen, since the second after it happened, I have had a knot in my stomach that has never gone away. I think that's what they mean when they say when you kill someone, a little part of yourself dies. That must be what makes humans different from animals. I'm still trying to figure it out. The time that the knot subsides a little bit is when I offer someone in here a little assistance. So what will happen when I get out, I hope, is that I will be able to convince some of these people who think that what I've done is cool not to go down the same path. He looks around the room and he goes, this is not cool. This is not fabulous. And then he says, maybe if I would have died during that struggle, maybe then it would have been cool. And he laughs. But he said, I know in my heart and soul that I have the ability to become.
That is such a self-gratification comment. Like, oh, look at this terrible thing I did, but it's not that bad because I learned from it. That is so bullshit. Well, there's another interview I saw from him where he's talking about how an interviewer asked him, it was like after he came out of prison, they're like, hey, so would you ever apologize to Angel's family, this, that, blah, blah. He's like, well, they actually have like you know, things against me. I can't talk to them. I can't say anything to them. But he's like, but if they were to reach out to me, I would say that, hey, your son, we didn't hate him. Like, he was an all right guy, like this, that, blah, blah. And he never apologizes.
He never says, I'm sorry.
Yeah, he never apologizes. He never says anything else. He's just like, and he never says, like, if I were to reach out to them, I would say that. He goes, well, he's pretty much trying to push it, like, hey, you guys should come and reach out to me so I could tell you what I have to say, because legally, I'm not allowed to talk to you. And it never feels like he feels remorse for what happened to Angel, or he feels bad that their son is gone or their family member is gone or whatever. It sounds more like he's like, hey, come and message me so that I can be okay in terms of society, and I can apologize to you, and everyone can think that I'm an okay person.
Oh my gosh, it is. It really does get to where, like, his narcissism is way overboard. It's just like right here, he's saying that, oh, I could have become a Larry T or a RuPaul, one of the successful ones who's able to lead a creative, artistic, even edgy lifestyle. You can be edgy without being self-destructive. I know that I'm smart enough to do it. I'm smart enough to do anything.
It just sounds really bitter. God. It just sounds like, okay, you murdered someone, you didn't get famous, and now you're bitter about
exactly. it. Okay, so they were sentenced 10 to 20 years for manslaughter, and they both pled not guilty to first-degree murder because they said it was in self-defense. 10 to 20 years for murder? I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it. I couldn't get a lot about Freeze's time, but Michael was up for parole in 2006 and it was denied, and he was up again for it in 2008. In one of his interviews, he said, I know why I blabbed. I must have wanted to stop myself. I was spinning out of control. It's like the old saying, what do you have to do to get attention around here? Kill somebody? It's like, God.
Bad joke.
Can't with this kid.
And then he was released from prison in 2015, right? 2014 is when he was released from prison at the age of 48. He served 17 years.
17, yeah. And I don't think that he ever, you know, stopped using drugs. I don't think that. And you can look at James St. James's website, and he documented all the times that he talked to Michael on the phone, and it's called Phone Call from a Felon.
Yeah, it went right up until Michael was like, shut this shit down.
Yeah, it was crazy. But, you know, I think his drug use, like Ernie was talking about in his last episode of The Pew, after Michael was found dead in his apartment, I think he was 54. It was really sad to watch Ernie's last video about him.
It is, even though, like, okay, at the end of this, I do think that Michael, I'm not on his side. That's where I'm landing on the end of this story. In the beginning of the story, I start to feel bad for him. In the end, I don't feel as bad. I think that, but here's the thing. I still don't, I don't know that he got what he deserved. He did die in a fucking fucked up way.
Yeah.
I mean, dying on Christmas Eve is always sad.
Dude, and I felt Ernie through the freaking video. You could see the pain.
You could tell that he cares, and that's what I care for more than the actual death of Michael Alec. It's more for the fact that he did spawn this whole movement that did inspire a lot of people, mm-hmm. regardless of what he did. It did give a lot of people a voice and, like, a reason to live and do what they want to do. And that is the part that I feel for.
Yeah, and I'm so with you on that. I think the reason why I felt so bad was because of what you see in the videos and because of Ernie. I think seeing the sadness on Ernie's face really made me sad for him as a human trying to take care of his fellow human who he knew wasn't a great person. He pretty much said himself, you know, this demon tortured him, and that's why he couldn't let the drugs go, because you've got to quieten the thoughts with those drugs, and it was just such a battle. I think one other person in the movie that I did want to touch on a little bit was Gitzy, because her part was exaggerated just a little. Like, she even said, like, they weren't in a relationship or, like, anything like that, but they were good friends. And the part in the movie, she had written down in a journal about their trip before he got arrested. They kind of fled out of the state. And then they came back and stayed in, like, New Jersey, I think. But they fled New York and before he pled guilty. And Gitsy was the one who went with him. And she had to hold in this secret because she's like, why do you have to go, Michael? Like, why are we doing this? And then he tells her. And so she's like the first person that really gets that honest answer. And then she passed away. Because everybody wanted to know if Gitsy was still alive. She was discovered by a roommate in a bed in their apartment from a drug overdose on January 12th, 1998.
Yeah, so that was right after Michael went in prison. He went in prison, I think, in 97.
Mm-hmm. So it might have been a lot on her mind about all of this and could have contributed to that. Hmm. But yeah, I think reading Disco Bloodbath, watching the shockumentary, the movie, I went down such a huge rabbit hole with this one, and I loved it. Like, I loved every minute of writing about it, reading about it, watching the videos, and I think everyone should fall down that rabbit hole, too, and just make up their own thoughts and feelings about it.
I actually agree, because this is something that I honestly, like, genuinely, I did not know anything about the Club Kids. I didn't know who they were. I didn't know who was involved before you told me about this. And this is something that I'm going to keep. I mean, I have not finished even getting through the beginning of all of the fucking, like, talk show appearances and everything involved.
Yeah,
like, everything
it's a
on
lot.
YouTube. There's so
it's
much.
A lot.
Yeah, and it was really fun to research for the episode, but it's something that I am actually still going to look into after this, and it's kind of like, I guess almost influenced me in a way to kind of like just get more, like, obtain more knowledge on this crowd of people that I didn't really know much about.
Yeah, the subculture is really interesting, and, you know, I've seen people that are on the comments of Nelson's videos going, wow, this was like 4 years ago. They were like, I started this YouTube channel, like going through it after looking up Michael Alec. And then now I'm still here, like years later, watching all of these videos and still learning about each person. And I love it. It's that subculture really influenced, you know, New York and the times. And it's just... It's really crazy.
Shitty story. Michael Alec kind of gave a bad name for the Club Kids, but I think as far as the Club Kids go in general, I think it's a really beautiful movement. I think it's really amazing, like, as a whole. I think it's fucking awesome. Yeah. I think it sucks that that they're kind of tarnished with this bad name, but I think that pretty much everyone involved, except for Michael Alec and maybe a few other ne'er-do-wells, I think it's a really good movement. I think it's really good to research.
Totally agree. Thank you so much for, you know, coming on and talking about this with me. I appreciate it, and, you know, I always love when we do little things together and just, like... It just means a lot that you would come on and do this with me. So thank you for letting, you know, me drag you down this rabbit hole with me.
Of course, dude. I mean, thanks for picking a really cool topic. And thanks for, you know, like, letting me kind of get this out again. Because I haven't wanted to do true crime on my show for a while. I don't want to lock that in again yet because I have too much else going on. And it was fun being able to do something again. You know, I've been kind of itching to talk about some fun stuff.
Well, I can't wait until you know, do feel like doing true crime back on Horror Soup. You and Bree used to do True Crime Thursdays, right?
Yes, yeah, we did.
So, you know, if y'all need some more true crime, y'all can just go through the Horror Soup, you know, and just find all the True Crime Thursdays, too. Those are really interesting, so that'd be fun.
Yeah, there's some out there if you guys want to check that out, you know. I mean, it's like a good, like, it's been like a good year since I've done them, I'm sure, or maybe close to a year, but, you know, they're still there. They're around.
Yeah. Yeah, well, thank you so much. And if you want to close us out with, like, what your other podcasts are again and how people can get in touch with you, find you, all that good stuff.
Yeah, guys, if you want to follow on, like, social medias, I mainly use Instagram just because I'm too lazy to go on everything else. But you could find, like, Horror Soup on just Horror Soup at Instagram, Scream Podcast at Scream Podcast on Instagram. That's the one I host with Elena and Ash from Morbid, a True Crime Podcast. And then You can find pretty much most of the things I do on Horror Soup on YouTube. I'm kind of doing a switch pretty soon, and I haven't even like officially announced this on my shows, but I guess since I don't know when I'm going to do a next guest thing, you could follow Soup Incorporated on YouTube also, and that's just kind of where I do everything that's not horror movies. Like, that's kind of where the Donkey Fellatio feed is going to move to pretty soon. I don't even know if that show is going to stay what it is. But pretty much everything I do that's not horror movies is going to be on Soup Incorporated on YouTube. And then everything else, if you want to find video stuff, Horror Soup on YouTube. And then just check out the shows. I do a lot of horror movie shows. I do, like, other stuff where I just talk about life shit or just fucking joke around with my friends or do whatever. It's pretty much, yeah. It's everything I got going. Yeah. I guess I'm on Twitch sometimes, too. But
we love that. You know. We love that. Well, I love it, and thank you again, and thank you all for listening to this week's episode, and until next time, stay safe, take care, and I love ya.
Can I sign us out?
Yeah, go ahead, go for it.
Hey guys, this is Hulk Hogan, and you are listening to the Reverie True Crime Podcast with the baddest bitch from the South, Paige. Go ahead and check out all of her other episodes and everything that she does, because, Southern Paradise, baby.
Oh, thanks, Caleb.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
You're awesome.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.